alaikum. Peace be upon you. And this is the greeting you hear all through the Islamic world. Before I start on the DVD and my PowerPoint, I want to tell you about what I'm wearing. I'm wearing a shalwar kameez and a dupatta on my head. This is the national dress of Pakistan. You'll see it in India a lot. You'll see it somewhat in Afghanistan. And men and women wear essentially the same thing, except your man's would probably have more like a shirt collar, and you get a pocket to put your things in. The head covering, I have some friends who are Muslim, some women who said, yes, you need to wear that. I have other women who say, no, that's optional. Modest dress is required, but the head covering isn't. It's warm, and I'm not used to it, so I'm going to take that off. This is the kameez. It's like a tunic top, split up the side, and men, you would wear this, and underneath the shalwar with the drawstring. And those of you that have read Three Cups of Tea will see I've tucked the drawstring in, so I'm wearing it properly. When I got to Pakistan, to Islamabad, I went to the hotel, freshened up, and they took me right to the material shop, where I chose what I wanted to wear. A lot of you aren't going to be here tomorrow. I'm going to wear my pretty one tomorrow. This is the plain one that I chose. It's warm, and that's why I wore it this morning, to wear in the mountain area. Some time ago, I was at a book club, and a woman asked me, who made your shalwar kameez? And I said, well, I went to the material shop, I picked out my material, the tailor measured me, and the next morning I went back, a little under $25, I had two complete outfits, and she said, was the tailor a man? Well, yes. Can a man in that culture measure a woman who's not his relative? Well, I didn't know, so when Greg phoned, I said, Greg, who made my shalwar kameez? And he said, a lady tailor. And I said, no, it wasn't a lady. It was a man. He said, yes, but he was a lady tailor. He was a tailor. He was a tailor. He was married. He was in good standing in the community. He attended Friday services. He prayed regularly. He fasted during Ramadan. So he went to the imam of his mosque, got a letter of recommendation, took it to the government, and became a lady tailor. And I always tell people, you don't know anything about the morals of the people who made your clothing, but mine was made by a very upstanding man. In Afghanistan, you'll see a lot of the chador, or burqa, where they're completely covered except for their eyes. That isn't prescribed in the Quran nor in the Hadith. It started in Saudi Arabia, where the very wealthy women wore them so that the common people couldn't gaze upon them when they were out in public. Well, if the wealthy women wore them, the middle class women started to wear them. And it became, and a lot of people believe that that is a requirement, that women wear this complete covering. I know it's a little facetious, but I always do say, Lutherans do not have to wear a Norwegian sweater on Christmas Eve. And I have taken off my shoes. Now, I don't have to do that here. If I were to go to your home, I would need to take off my shoes. Always in a mosque, always in a church, and it's a sign of respect. Shoes are considered dirty. And so, out of respect for all of you and for this place, I have taken off my shoes. I want to start with a little video here. This was on CNN earlier this year. Two things. The statistics are wrong. really wrong. I've got much better ones to report to you. And pay attention to the Lalander School, because I have a really marvelous story to tell you about that a little bit later. Come on. What's happened? Well, maybe we'll do it without that. But it is a very nice DVD. Yeah, but no, that's not. I had it all set up at the right place.
Attractive to the message of extremism, it's simply a question.
Ventures in Pakistan and here in Afghanistan.
Well, let's just watch this and then try starting again. Sorry.
He's now a White House advisor on Muslim youth.
Without question of them being ideologically attractive to the message of extremism, it's simply a question of that's where the jobs are, that's where the school is, that's where the free lunch program is. I think that one of the central issues of the 21st century is that we will rise or fall on them rising or falling.
Shakirullah is one who has fallen. His madrasa education landed him behind bars, where he is now facing at least 5 years for his attempted suicide bombing. Up next, I tracked down an American who's devoted his life to giving the children of Afghanistan and Pakistan something better. Dangerous back road in Afghanistan heading towards Taliban country to meet one of America's most successful fighters against extremism. At our rendezvous, we're approached by the security details. Famously hard to track down, today Greg Mortensen is surrounded by armed men, but that's not how he fights his battles.
The old village chief once told me, if you really want to do something here, you need 3 cups of tea.
3 cups of tea is the title of Greg's best-selling book, based on his real-life adventures in Pakistan and here in Afghanistan.
First cup, you're a stranger. Second cup, a friend. And third cup, you become family. And for a family, you're prepared to do anything, even die.
Greg's own brush with death gave him his lifelong mission. 15 years ago, this American from Montana attempted to scale the world's second highest peak, Pakistan's treacherous K2. But he failed, stumbling down the mountain, starving, sick, and exhausted. He was nursed back to health in a remote village in the foothills.
One day, I walked behind the village and saw 84 children sitting in the dirt during the school lessons. Most of them were riding with sticks in the sand. And there was that very rash moment they asked for help to go to school. This is in September 93. I said, I'll promise to go to school for you.
Mm-hmm.
I built a school and then 78 more and still doing it today.
Working with local villagers, Greg's Central Asia Institute now educates 30,000 students, mostly girls, in places where outsiders dare not venture.
Our primary area of focus is in areas where there are no schools or there's no girls going to school. And that's usually because of conflict, religious extremism, or areas of very remote physical isolation.
Places like Lalanda Village. Last stop on today's very rough journey.
Like the bus here.
Once we get there, Greg finds good friends waiting for him. Like Fazal Ahmed. Before visiting the school, they will pray together at his son's grave.
He's the brightest student in the school. He's 11. He was herding goats after school. He stepped on this old Soviet mine here, blasted him off. He died about 10 hours later from shock.
When Fuzzle got over the shock of losing his son, he decided to do two things. Dedicate his life to removing Afghanistan's landmines, and make sure that his daughters got the chance his son never did.
I want all of them to be educated and become whatever they want to be. Doctors, engineers, or teachers. If they have education, they can do it. But without it, they can't do a thing.
His 13-year-old daughter, Saida, studies in this homeschool that Greg has organized because the Taliban targets public schools for girls.
Saida, do you like learning? Are you glad you're being educated?
Yes, I'm happy to learn so I can have a good future.
What do you want to be?
Doctor.
A doctor. Do you think girls can be future leaders of Afghanistan? Can you be a leader?
If you're educated, of course.
Why is it so important to educate girls beyond the obvious equality?
When I see girls learning how to read and write, I often teach their mother how to read and write.
Not only does this improve the lives of their family and their community, but Greg has also found that educated women can be a firewall against extremism.
When someone goes on jihad, they first should get permission and blessings from their mother. If they don't, it's very shameful or disgraceful. And I saw that happen after 9/11. They were primarily targeting illiterate, impoverished society because many educated women were refusing to allow their sons to join the Taliban.
The Taliban target schools, and in the last 2 years, 640 have been closed. They tried to do it right here in Lalanda.
About a dozen Taliban came in at night. There were some shots fired, and the next they said, if anybody comes to school, we're going to kill you. But the community basically got the Taliban out of here.
Greg believes the villagers are willing to fight for their schools because they provide the land and the labor.
The guards who got orders from the commandant that if anybody harms any student or shoot them, just kill them. Don't ask questions.
Really, commandant? It's a shoot to kill order?
Yes, absolutely. 100%.
This was a day to give Greg a hero's welcome. And to celebrate the feast of Nowruz, the Afghan New Year. Should I sit down? Is that appropriate? I'll sit down here. Greg Mortensen's 15-year battle.
So that I think I maybe should change this around and do that last, because coming on after Christina Amanpour is kind of So I want to start by telling you about three cups of tea. I talked to a couple of people today that were in Seattle when Greg was having a hard time even getting an audience at REI. Washington State has always been very, very helpful with this. But anyway, since Three Cups of Tea has come out, it's really made a change for Greg. So I'm going to start by telling you a little bit about Three Cups of Tea. It came out over 4 years ago now, and just before it was published, Greg went to New York, met with the publishers, and saw the cover. And he was delighted with those three little girls and how they did cups of tea. It almost looked a little like Urdu's script, but he was really shocked. It said, "One man's mission to fight terrorism." And Greg said, "I don't want that." He said, "I'm not fighting terrorism. Fighting terrorism is based in fear. And we really need to give hope. I want that changed." And they said, "Greg, there's something you need to learn about publishing these books. Authors don't choose the title. And we even let you choose Three Cups of Tea. Editors don't choose the title. The title is chosen by the marketing department. And the marketing department says what's going to sell this book is fighting terrorism." Well, Greg realized there was really nothing he could do, and the book was going to come out right away. So he said, but he hadn't been raised in Africa, worked in Pakistan, and had a Norwegian-German heritage for nothing. So he drove a bargain. He said, "If this book ever comes out in paperback, I want the title changed to Promoting Peace." And they agreed. Greg said, probably because they thought this book is never going to come out in paperback. For one thing, the first chapter starts with the word failure. And the publisher said, "Americans are not going to buy a book that starts with failure." Well, the book sold 30, 40,000, which isn't good, but it was good enough. It came out in paperback 183 weeks ago. It's been on the top 10 of the New York Times best-selling nonfiction paperback ever since the first time it came out. Over 4 million copies in 35 different countries it's been published. Hope, not fear. Now, some of this I'm going to go through rather quickly because a lot of you aren't going to be able to be here for the next session. So Greg's story did start in Africa. He was 3 months old when we went. He was 13 when we came back. And for his 12th birthday, all he wanted to do was climb Kilimanjaro. They didn't have 12-year-olds climbing Kilimanjaro. But the porter said, "Well, he's living here, you know, we know him, they knew what we were doing, my husband was building a hospital, yeah, we'd take him up." Well, I thought they didn't let other women's 12-year-olds climb the mountain, I didn't know why my 12-year-old should, but his dad said, "Go for it." And he got to the top. He admits he had a headache, he was vomiting, the porters were pushing him, but he said, "The view of the world from the top of the world, and we're getting some of that here, is really something to see." And he got hooked on mountain climbing. Years later, he went to the Karakorams. That's the largest concentration of high peaks in the world. Admire this picture, please, because I took it myself out of the airplane window. And the highest of those peaks is K2. A far more difficult mountain to climb than Everest, because the weather is so unpredictable and there's much more technical climbing. Well, I think, how many of you have read Three Cups of Tea? Okay, I don't need to tell you, he didn't make it to the top. And he got lost. And as they said, he was separated from everyone else, and here he was, wandering down the mountain, this American young man singing a German hymn in Swahili, where he had learned it in Pakistan. But he was alone, and Muzaffar rescued him. Muzaffar is about this tall, and he is so strong. Right in this picture, he's got a 70-pound pack on his back. He took Greg's tent, sleeping bag, cooking things, put it all on his back. I met him, and I was Greg's mother. He hugged me. I didn't breathe again all week. Well, Greg got separated from him, got lost again, and you know, sometimes when we lose our way, we find our way, and he stumbled into the village of Corfe. And that's where he found the 84 children, 5 girls, 79 boys, sitting scratching multiplication tables in the dirt. No teacher. Corfe was a very poor village. They could scrape up $3 a week to pay Master Hussein for 3 days, but they couldn't do 6. So there they were. And Greg said, well, what do you do in the wintertime? They have harsh winters there, and they took him to the winter school. This was it. Dug down, so they were sitting on dirt. There is no glass in that window. That open doorway, a heavy wool blanket was hung, and this is what it looked like inside. Mm-hmm. Sitting close together, and that's when he said, I will build you a school. Well, he came home, and his first talks, not many people there. So he went to the library, found the addresses of 580 famous people, football stars, movie stars, you know, dear Oprah, dear Sylvester Stallone, so and so and so and so. 580, not one reply. Until Christmas time, when he got a letter from Tom Brokaw, who had also graduated from the University of South Dakota, and Tom Brokaw sent $100. He also wrote the blurb on the back of Three Cups of Tea. Now, Tom has a ranch near Livingston, Montana, and they had dinner there not too long ago. And Tom told Greg, everywhere I go, airports, TV stations, newspaper, everybody is asking me about Three Cups of Tea. And he said, and you can't believe the bad time my children are giving me. They're asking me, everyone knows about it, and I only sent $100. Well, Greg told him the blurb on the back of the book was priceless. What he didn't tell him that I find very amusing is Central Asia Institute gets a lot of checks for $101, and in the corner of the check it'll say more than Tom Brokaw. Well, then he came to the school where I was principal in River Falls, Wisconsin, and showed pictures of the children in Pakistan, and it was, you know, a geography lesson. He didn't even think of any fundraising or anything. And at the end of one day, a fourth grade boy came and said, I've got a piggy bank at home. I'm going to bring it to school so you can build that school. Well, a piggy bank can't build a school, but it did. The children got excited. Student council said, we'll sponsor it. Then when the faculty met, one wise first grade teacher said, let's have this fundraiser be only pennies. If it's only pennies, the poorest child in school is going to be as much a part of it as everyone else. And that's exactly what happened. 6 weeks later, they counted the money, 62,345 pennies. There was not a penny on the sidewalk, under a cushion, or in a grandma or grandpa's billfold in River Falls, I can guarantee you. One little boy brought a whole jar full of pennies, and his teacher thought, uh-oh, because this little boy was one, you know, he couldn't be too sure. He was so happy, he said, my mom put this on the counter in the bar, and all the guys... And with that, I tell another little story. Greg just told me there is a prison in Florida where the inmates are collecting pennies. Mm-hmm. And you know their incomes are so low. But one of the men who is in for bank robbery wrote Greg, when I get out, I'm really going to risk a lot of money. Has grown and grown. Last year, 130 million pennies, $1,300,000 came in. Yeah, there was some other money, but largely pennies and largely from school children in six continents. Now, Greg was just very recently in Denver and telling about this. And there was a young woman there who was just deployed to Antarctica. And it wasn't pennies, but she sent a check to CAI so he could say seven continents. When pennies, we had pennies for Pakistan, but as it spread, it's become pennies for peace. And I've talked to some other people here, if you are with the group, and working with children and they want to do pennies, perhaps your school or church or scout troop has some special thing. Central Asia Institute is happy to send all the material. It doesn't have to go to them. But when this started, a penny will buy a pencil in Afghanistan. And my emphasis was on what it did there. But I'm seeing more and more what it does for children here. I was in a small town in Minnesota, and a little six-year-old kindergarten guy came up to me and said, I didn't have a penny. We didn't have any pennies in the house. So I took my dollar to the bank and bought some. And then he asked me, was that cheating? And I assured him, no, it wasn't. And he said, well, what are they going to do with my 100 pennies? And I asked him, well, what do you want them to do? And he said, I want them to buy 100 pencils so 100 kids can write. And there he had that vision. And that's when I saw what it does for children here. I'm living in Alaska now. At the end of last year, I went to a middle school, and they had gotten really excited about it, and they wanted me to come so they could present the check to me, and so I agreed to go. Middle school kids in Alaska, they had raised $15,000. I was totally amazed. A school in Colorado, I think it was Fort Collins, they had collected I don't know how much in pennies, and somewhere along the line had lost track. So they were so eager to get them to the bank, and they'd be counted, they'd find out how much they were in the bank, said, we can't handle that many at one time. You're going to have to bring them in smaller amounts. Well, fourth grade class, I mean, they'd collected all this money, so kids in Afghanistan could learn to read and write, and here the bank wouldn't even take it. They wrote a letter to the editor. It was published, and that day three other banks in town called. We'd be happy to take the money, and one bank said, we'll send our armored car over. You probably can guess where that school is banking. Oh, and I forgot to tell you something about 3 cups of tea. They just did a second edition of the hardcover. Mm-hmm. Guess what the title of the hardcover is? Promoting Peace. Well, with that, they could buy supplies, because when some adults heard children were raising pennies to build the school, Tom Herney, this microchip inventor, heard about it. He'd been in the Karakorums. They could buy the supplies. I took this picture so you could see back there the Karakoram Highway. It's rather like the road up here. And nobody calls this one a highway. But that was it. I was really frightened on that, because sometimes it's so narrow and you look down the steep bank to the river. And this is the bridge. I was even more frightened of the bridge. I couldn't close my eyes, of course. If I looked down, I saw that river. If I looked up, I saw that cliff I had to climb, so I kind of looked straight ahead. And then I climbed the cliff, and when I got to the top, I thought, maybe I'll live in Corfe the rest of my life. Way up in the upper right, you see the cable that used to go across, where they had the pulley and the box underneath, and that's, I don't think I would have gone if I would have had to go in that. Well, with that, these men carried that wood 18 miles. They walked during the dark night, 18 miles, loaded it up 18 miles back, 36 miles that day, and with loads. And the man in front is the village imam. Now, don't any of you tell any pastors here or your pastor or anyone that in that society, pastors do no physical work. Someone else digs their garden. Someone else takes care of their irrigation canal. He was so delighted, so happy. They were going to have a school. He led the procession. And as a child, he had polio, and he walks with great difficulty, but he still helped bring up that first load. Well, the school was going. Greg was construction foreman. This kind of surprised me. He'd never built anything in his life. And, you know, he had his plumb line, and Muhammad do this, and Hussein do that, and where's Musa today? And this took several months. And Haji Ali, the village headman, called Greg aside and said, Greg, we really appreciate what you're doing, but you are driving us crazy. And then he asked, would Greg do them a favor? And Greg said, well, he'd do anything. He said, will you sit down and shut up? And Greg was banished from the construction site. The men were all working. The boys were helping them. So the women were taking over some of the heavy field work and doing the irrigation canal. So the grandmothers were doing the cooking, and the girls were helping them. So the old men, who usually do nothing more than maybe spin a little wool and sit around and talk, were taking care of the little children. And Greg was doing nothing. So he decided he would teach some English. So he went down to this field, and the old men would come with the little ones. And one of the first things he taught them was Mary Had a Little Lamb. Very culturally appropriate. Mary, the mother of Jesus, is mentioned more often in the Quran than in the Bible. Miriam is a very common name throughout the Islamic world. And of course the children knew about lambs. I mean, they raised sheep and goats. And they thought it hilariously funny that any lamb was dumb enough to go down the hill to the school where there wasn't any grass at all rather than up the mountain. Well, this took several months. Greg got out of the way 6 weeks later. The school was done. He said his first lesson was the three cups of tea. You have to build the relationship. His second lesson was, let the people do everything they can. Don't help them, work with them. Well, then he was going to go back to the States, resume his nursing career. He had no intention of building any more than this first school when he started getting requests from other places. And he agreed at 5 more villages, that he would build schools and a fatwa. A religious decree was issued against him, saying that he was building schools for girls and a foreigner building schools, and girls' schools were forbidden, and that he had to leave Pakistan at once. Well, Greg didn't know what he should do, so he went to Saeed Abbas Rizvi, the head Shia Ayatollah in Pakistan. Pakistan is about 84% Sunni, maybe not quite 15% Shia, and then a few Aga Khan and a very few Christians, a little behind. But it's mostly that. He was the head Shia Ayatollah, and Greg said, what should I do? 2 fatwas now are issued against me. And he said he'd write to the religious scholars in Qom, Iran. And that's the place we've been hearing about lately with the nuclear facilities. And Greg waited. It was months. And he'd gone back to the States, back to Pakistan, and he was called into the inner part of the mosque. And he was sure that they would tell him he had to leave. And instead he got this red velvet box, and inside this beautiful letter saying, in English, it translated, "Dear compassionate of the poor, we are agreed that our Holy Quran does not forbid the education of girls. In fact, our Holy Prophet Muhammad says all should seek knowledge, including our daughters and sisters. And furthermore, there is nothing to say that an infidel, a foreigner, could not build schools. This is acting in the highest principles of Islam, to tend the poor and the sick." And with that, they left instructions that no one should interfere with his plans. And so with that, he could build schools, and girls could go to those schools. I'm not going into all of the reasons this morning on girls' schools. On page 34 of the Journey of Hope, it has a lot of them. But I think one of the things we really need to remember, it is very disgraceful in Islam if you go on jihad without your mother's permission. A jihad of going to secondary school, college, going to the city to buy to get money to buy land, those the mothers will approve, but educated women are not approving their sons joining Al-Qaeda or the Taliban, any more than educated women in our cities are approving their sons belonging to gangs. I often think when I read in the paper, why doesn't Pakistan or why doesn't Afghanistan take care of their Taliban? A lot of them are just gangs, and I think they could say, why can't we do something about our gangs here? But that's a beside. Aren't they just the most beautiful children? The whole family was there in 2007, and I asked my granddaughter, Amira, what did you see as the biggest difference? And I thought maybe she'd say a lot of rote learning, not enough books to go around, many things, and she said, the biggest difference I saw, she says, you know, Grandma, some mornings I wake up and I think, oh, I've got to go to school. She said, there, every student I talked to said, I get to go to school. And that's what she saw. It's not a have to, it's a privilege, and they are thrilled to be able to go to school. The Taliban now have closed or destroyed over 2,000 schools in Afghanistan, over 650 in Pakistan. The Quran does not say schooling is forbidden. In fact, you're supposed to seek knowledge. The first word of the revelation to the Prophet Muhammad is Iqra, read. And the first 2 chapters talk about how everyone should seek knowledge. In the hadith, which isn't the revealed or inspired to Muhammad, but it's a book of writings that are considered very, Muhammad wrote a lot, his wife wrote some, but in the hadith it says, the ink of a scholar is holier than the blood of a martyr. Mm-hmm. And for suicide is forbidden. So all of this that we think, I used to think was part of Islam, is absolutely counter to what the religion proposes. But bad news, do you want to hear good news? In Afghanistan in the year 2000, when the Taliban were in control, there were 800,000 children in school, children and young people, mostly all male. Today there are almost 9 million. 2.5 million of them are girls. And as women are learning to read and reading the Quran for themselves, widows are finding out that the Quran says if a man dies, his widow should inherit. Tribally, in most of those areas, when a man dies, his brothers inherit the property, as in the Old Testament was happening. These widows are finding out the Quran says they should have it. And so they can go to government court, or they can go to Islamic court, and they're winning the land. Greg says, in this country, we're so focused on the vote. And he said, you know, if you're illiterate, and you don't own anything, a vote doesn't mean much. But as you become literate, as you have something that you can support yourself and family with, votes become very important. This is the school in Hushay. If there are some villages, they build schools, they're building girls' schools if there's a boys' school already. If there's no school at all, they build a co-educational one. But the village elders and the school council have to agree that they'll increase the girls by 10% a year until it's about equitable. This is Hushay, the very first day the school opened. This is the first day of the next year. Not too good at math if they thought they only needed 10%. Way on the left, standing up, is Aslan. Aslan was the only educated man in the village. He'd gone through 10th grade. If you ask a man in that society the proudest day of his life, they'll usually say the day my first son was born. Aslan said the day my two daughters got to go to school. And the tallest girl there is his oldest daughter. She's in her fourth year of medical school. She will be the first doctor ever of the Balti people, tribe of over a million, and she's going back to Hushay to open her clinic. This is Aziza. Aziza, very bright, and no girl in that village had ever gone to school. Her father recognized it and decided she should go to school. And her mother's brothers, her uncles, who hold a lot of sway in decisions, also decided she could go to school. So she was the one lone girl in that whole school. And in first and second grade, the boys threw rocks at her. Third and fourth grade teachers would not let her in the classroom. So her father bought her pencil and paper, and she sat outside the window and wrote down everything she heard the teacher saying. She was allowed to go to fifth grade, and in Pakistan there's a fifth grade exam that you have to pass to go on. She got the highest score in the village. She went on to school through 10th grade, and then there was just nothing available to her except for miles away, and you have to have a chaperone or a proper place, and besides, they had no money. Greg happened to be in that village, and she came to him and said, I have finished 10th grade. I have very high exam scores. Is there any way Central Asia Institute, any way you, she asked him, can help me go to school? But it's going to cost, the equivalent of $400 a year for my transportation, room, board, tuition, all of that, and we just don't have that money. She became the first ever scholarship student of CAI. She wanted to study maternal health care. Her mother had died in childbirth, as 5 to 25 women did every year in the Hunza Valley where she lived. She finished in 2000. Not a single woman has died in childbirth since. And you'll notice it's a young boy who's got a fever there that she's, and those same now young men who used to throw rocks at her, if they got a sore throat or infected leg or something, they go to Aziza. And because these people have never had antibiotics and you don't need prescriptions for them, Greg said, you'd be amazed at what antibiotics can do in that population. And another brave girl, the tall one. In 2005, there was a horrible earthquake in Pakistan. Not the area that's flooding now. It seems like there's just a curse. But anyway, 80,000 people died, 18,000 of them were school children, whole villages disappeared. And in this particular village, they, in fact, CAI didn't have schools there at all, and they wanted to do something, so they chose 8 either refugee camps or villages where the girls had already been in school. They thought rather than starting new schools, maybe it would be best so they wouldn't have to interrupt or they could continue. And in this particular refugee camp, they built the school and the girls wouldn't go. So Greg went to the elders and said, why weren't they going? Well, maybe they were so traumatized they don't want to leave their mothers. So he went to the mothers. Well, no, they'll get water, they'll get fuel, the girls get together. She came and told Greg, we'll go to school if we have desks. Well, that seemed strange until he found out that at the earthquake, all the older boys had desks, and when the roofs caved in and the rubble piled up, very few boys died. It was all girls and young children. So they got some old boards, made some desks, and then Greg found out that the desks are a real symbol. So even in their outdoor schools now, they're putting desks. This was a classroom he found in Afghanistan, 9th grade boys, studying English. And here's where the girls were going to school. Remember I told you I took off my shoes out of respect? Look at this. There they are, sitting outside. You don't have to take your shoes off in school. The boys didn't in the personnel carrier, but these girls have taken off their shoes. And their teacher is an ex-Taliban. He was shamed into quitting the Taliban by his mother. And she told him, you have to do something for your people. He went back to school, I think finished 10th grade, took teacher training, and now he is teaching girls, as there are 6 ex-Taliban teaching now in CAI schools. And Greg said, if you want to talk about brave people, they're right at the top of the wanted list by the Taliban, because they're doing exactly the opposite of what they want to have happen. If you want to have power, have an illiterate population. This is the family. Amira's 13 now. She says, Grammy, you got to get a different picture. As Greg said, a lot of the little girls are teaching their mothers how to read. If you go to the markets there, they usually use newspapers to wrap your rice, meat, dried apricots, dried mulberries. And in a place where you do all your cooking over open fire, newspapers are wonderful to start fires. But now at night, after they've eaten, when chores are done, if the family has a lamp, the mothers will smooth out the newspapers and their daughters read to them. First time ever those women have heard anything about the outside world. Greg's favorite thing, working with the children. He said, you have to build relationships, let them do what they can, listen to the ones most directly concerned, even though it's a child, and then he found out you have to listen to your own children. The family went to Pakistan in 2007, and Amira, who was 10 at the time, asked her dad, what do they play with? Well, he said, they have maybe a soccer ball or maybe a cricket ball and bat, but not much. So she decided she was going to take jumping ropes. And she went to Gold's Gym and I don't know, Walmart, Kmart, and she got several thousand, and they couldn't take them all. They shipped most of them, but she took a suitcase full. And they went to one refugee village, and she said, this is where I want to give the jumping ropes. And Greg said, you know, Amira, I don't think it's appropriate here. These people have been so traumatized. They've lost their homes, their land, their cattle, their families, friends. They don't know where they're going to go back. And he said, it's just a traumatic, sad situation. Well, she insisted. And she gave out the jumping ropes, and she taught them some tricks, and they started learning jumping tricks, and the children started laughing. And some of the parents told Greg that was the first time they'd heard their children laugh since the earthquake. And when the children started laughing, the parents started having hope. And when the parents started having hope, they started talking about what they were going to do, where they were going to move, were they going back to the old area. It made such a difference. And then, Amira said, and Dad, there's something really wrong with all your schools. And Greg was quite proud of all his schools. She said, they don't have any playground equipment. So they started putting in swings and slides. And those children that have to do chores in the morning are getting up at 4:30, 5 o'clock, doing their chores, having a cup of tea, a chapati if they're lucky, and they run to school to play on the swings and slides. Well, in Baltistan, in that northeast corner of Pakistan, they've kind of concentrated schools. They're doing something different in Afghanistan. They're leapfrogging. Greg says, we're building a necklace around the Pashtun, the area where they get the Taliban mainly from. And in 10, maybe 15 years, they hope to build schools right in the Pashtun area. Well, last July, a group of elders, the Shura from Mullah Omar, the head of the Taliban in Afghanistan, from Mullah Omar's village, came to Lalander School, the one I told you about, and they wanted to see the school and what they did. And so the headmaster came and and they probably spent an hour or more because they all wanted to try it out. And then the headmaster said, well, don't you want to come and see the school now? And they said, we have seen enough. We want a girls' school with a playground in our compound. So I have a new solution for world peace, a compound, playground in every compound in Afghanistan. And I emailed that to a cousin, and he mailed back and said, you know, that's very interesting because I just read a research study out of England on serial killers. And the one thing they have found they all had in common, they didn't have fun as children. First grade class, first time any girls in that village ever went to school. This school, they counted every girl in the village and made the school large enough so every girl could go. They knew they wouldn't all go. They had twice as many girls there as room the first day of school. Some girls had walked over 2 hours because they heard there was going to be a school.
Are the teachers of girls usually men or women?
Right now, they're often men, they would prefer women, and more women are finishing school and going to teacher training, they are having women. This is a women's literacy center, and Waukeel standing there is helping them. They started that about 7 years, a little over 7 years ago, and in that time, until last year, they had 17. And then they totally turned it over to the women. This year there are 128. But what's remarkable about this one, 80% of the Afghan army is illiterate. At this literacy center, there were several soldiers that walked 2 hours and said, "Would you have night classes for us?" Now think of that. If the Afghan army is going to learn read and write by some women, wouldn't that be a gigantic change? Oh man, I've talked too long here. Greg has asked woman after woman, "What do you really want?" And he expects them to say, "Oh, a good husband, a nice house, good fields. I want my babies not to die, and I want my children to go to school." You know, both of those are really attainable. He said, "I went to Pakistan to conquer a mountain, and instead, the people conquered my heart." When one of the last schools in Afghanistan opened, he just happened to notice it was dusty, and he saw all these little footprints. Some in rubber boots, some in flip-flops, and a lot of little bare feet, and it reminded him of when Neil Armstrong landed on the moon. One small step for man, but a giant leap for mankind. And he said, "All these little small steps for each child, but a giant leap for this village, for Afghanistan, and hopefully for world peace." You know, in Matthew 25, when Jesus is talking to his disciples, "I was hungry and you fed me, I was thirsty and you gave me drink." I think if that was happening today, he would have said, "I was illiterate and you taught me how to read." Thank you.